Good evening and welcome to Counterpoint. My name is Scott Harris here, Mondays between 8 and 10. We're very happy you tuned in this evening. We've got a lot of important issues, as per usual, to discuss and get some analysis on from perspectives you're not likely to hear in the corporate media. And a little later this evening, we're going to be, again, taking time to explore the energy dimension of the Ukraine crisis with Ken Balsong, who's a director of the Sunday Campaign. A little later, Drew Hudson will be here to talk about his group, the Environmental Action Organization's campaign to convince National Public Radio to stop taking corporate sponsorship from the American Natural Gas Alliance, which is using its underwriting airtime to promote hydraulic fracturing, or fracking as it's known commonly. A little later this evening, Sarah Anderson from the Institute for Policy Studies will be talking about her new report, Wall Street Bonuses and the Minimum Wage, really talking about the impact of billions of dollars in bonuses for Wall Street stockbrokers and other mucky mucks in the trading floor, with what kind of stimulus, a boost in the minimum wage would bring the country, economic stimulus. So that's later this evening. But right now I'm very happy to welcome back to our program Ray McGovern, a retired 27-year veteran CIA officer who, during his career, briefed Presidents Reagan and Herbert Walker Bush before retiring in 1990. He later founded the group Veteran Intelligence Professionals for Sanity. Last October, Ray McGovern traveled to Moscow with other former U.S. intelligence officers to present ex-NSA contractor Edward Snowden, who has been granted temporary asylum in Russia, the annual Sam Adams Award for his courage as a whistleblower. The award is given each year by the Sam Adams Associates for Integrity and Intelligence. Ray McGovern, it's great to have you on the air tonight. Thanks for being here.
Glad to be with you.
So we had invited you to discuss a bit about the conflict that broke out into the open between the Senate Intelligence Committee and the CIA director. And I also wanted to, before we say goodnight a little later this evening, to take stock of what's happened in Ukraine, given your experience during the Cold War years with Russia and the Eastern Bloc and so on. But maybe, first of all, I'll just kind of start this off by mentioning what many of our listeners are aware of, that last Tuesday, California Democratic Senator Dianne Feinstein, a longtime supporter of the CIA, and chair of the Senate Intelligence Committee, made a dramatic speech on the Senate floor that condemned the CIA for a long campaign to cover up the agency's post 9/11 torture program, and what she said were allegations of spying on Senate legislative staff. Maybe you could summarize for our listeners what's going on here and its importance.
Well, it's a deal here where Congress, who's supposed to be overseeing the CIA, is kind of playing a reverse game here with the CIA overseeing what Congress is doing. In a word, Feinstein learned that the CIA was messing around with the staffers that she had working on this torture report, and that it was withholding some information, that it was withdrawing information already made available. And in the meantime, we learned that the president himself, the White House, has withheld thousands and thousands of documents having to do with torture. Now, people remember that our country and most civilized countries always regarded as torture as beyond the pale. And when you include things like waterboarding, well, ipso facto, it's torture, has always been regarded as torture ever since the Inquisition 500 years ago, okay? Well, after 9/11, everything changed. How often have you heard that phrase? Everything changed when Dick Cheney and George Bush said, well, we're going to give these captives the business. And I don't care, as George Bush famously said, I don't care what the international lawyers say, we're going to kick some ass. Now, the ironic thing here about torture is not only is it morally wrong, but it doesn't work. Despite what you see on television and the movies, it doesn't work. And when it finally became clear that the U.S. had an executive order from George Bush authorizing torture, and things began to get a little bit out of hand, George Bush decided on the 6th of September, 2006, to explain what was going on. He got up at the White House in the afternoon of September the 6th, 2006, and sort of talked about what he called an alternative set of procedures, which came to be known as enhanced interrogation techniques. Now, what Americans really would have no way of knowing is that enhanced interrogation techniques is a direct translation from the Gestapo handbook. The German words are verschärfte Vernehmung. Vernehmung is interrogation. Verschärfte, schärfer, sharpened or enhanced interrogation techniques. Now, that's bizarre enough, but the techniques themselves turned out to be precisely the same ones that Donald Rumsfeld, Dick Cheney, and CIA Director George Tenet were told were okay. Who told them that? Well, the lawyers at the Justice Department. As long as you don't kill them, as long as you don't disable a vital organ, you can do whatever you want with these people. So that's the very, very sad fact. Now, when Obama came into office, he did two things. One is he's going to shut down Guantanamo. Right? Well, he hadn't done that yet. It's been 5 years. Another thing is that he's going to cut off torture. No more torture. Well, the black sites, the black prisons in other countries and on ships where the CIA was allowed to employ this new tradecraft of torture, well, as far as I can tell, they have been shut down. Not so the Bagram facility there in Afghanistan, which still has a U.S. component to it, which is sort of beyond Dianne Feinstein's canon, that's for sure. And, of course, in Guantanamo itself, people have chosen to end it all by starving themselves to death. That's the only way that they can escape those conditions. And they've been denied that right by force feeding, which most medical associations and the world at large recognized to be another form of torture. So what I'm saying here is that Obama didn't end it all. He may have ended the most gross and the most conspicuous examples of torture. The third thing he did was to say, now we're not going to look back. We're just going to look forward. We're not going to hold the torturers accountable. That seemed pretty odd to the rest of us. And what he did was he left the torturers in charge of the CIA. I mean, it's still running the place. You can see them in the cafeteria. So what the deal there was that nobody's going to mess with these torturers because Obama, in my view, is afraid of them. He's afraid of the NSA. The NSA has the book on Obama. The NSA has the book on everybody. And I never thought I'd hear myself saying this, but Obama is afraid of our security forces. So when he decided not to pursue these folks, well, they got off pretty much free until it became clear that there were 96 videotapes of torture conducted in Thailand. Now, the White House counsel told the head of the CIA and his general counsel, do not destroy those tapes. The CIA destroyed those tapes. when that became known, mostly by an enterprising reporter from the Washington Post, then finally the senator said, and the Senate, of course, is run by Democrats, maybe we ought to, I got a good idea. Let's look into the CIA record on torture to see what was done, who did it, and what we should do in terms of planning for the future. And so 5 years ago, they started that effort, and it's been like pulling teeth to get the documents from the CIA. When the CIA does give documents, it gives them in bundles of 1,000, and they're not indexed or anything like that. So these Senate staffers, Dianne Feinstein's grandchildren, okay, they're eager and they're good, and they did a pretty creditable job for a long time, but that was mostly due to the CIA reluctance to share things. So up until recently, it's been one of these tug of wars. Dianne Feinstein has finished the report. It was finished more than a year ago, but John Brennan, the head of the CIA, who, by the way, was with the CIA and with George Tenet when all this was being done, he was fully aware of it. You can see that from how he was CC'd on all the messages having to do with torture, and he publicly has bragged about what he calls extraordinary rendition, which is also known as kidnapping, which is the sine qua non first step to torture some of the people who don't volunteer to be tortured, okay? So, be that as it may, Brennan is fully implicated in all this torture, and surprise, surprise, he has posed all manner of obstacles so that Dianne Feinstein's report from the Senate Select Committee on Intelligence, prepared and finished more than a year ago, has never seen the light of day. What does President Obama do? Well, he does what he usually does. Nothing. And all of a sudden, Dianne Feinstein finds out that not only is Brennan inhibiting her staffers, not only is the CIA not sharing all the information that they should share, and actually, not only are they withdrawing some of the information that they earlier shared, but they're spying on the activities of her staffers. Now, but Dianne Feinstein has been a big, big fan of John Brennan. Just think back a year ago when she waxed eloquent about this wonderful fella and how, among other things, only two people had been killed by drone strikes the previous year. Hello? So all of a sudden, she finds out not only that her staffers, these young people that she put to the, to the task of doing a report on CIA torture, not only have her staffers been treated very shabbily, but they have been accused of criminal activity. What I mean is that Brennan's general counsel filed a crime report. This is the genre of ours. You file a crime report when you think people have gotten access to classified material that they are authorized for. Now, I don't know exactly what set Dianne Feinstein off. Sometimes these things are very human things, but, mama bears and grandma bears can be pretty ferocious when they see their little cubs being pushed around. And I think she got a little tired of John Brennan and the rest of them pushing her young staffers around. And the last straw was this crime report where they accused of actually committing a crime and referred to the Justice Department and the FBI for investigation. And so she got her notes together and she spilled it all out last Tuesday without warning a soul. And, it's kind of hard for Dianne Feinstein to be accusing John Brennan and others of violating the Fourth Amendment when she has not only condoned but praised up and down the gross violations of that same amendment by the NSA. So people have been saying that Dianne Feinstein is giving hypocrisy a bad name, and that's largely correct. The good news is that it's out in the open now, and the president's going to be forced to deal with it one way or another. I think I know how he's going to deal with it, and we can get into that later, but I've probably talked too long already.
No, you got a great summary there of all these events that led up to the current conflict that's now in the open, as you said, Ray. Ray McGovern, President Obama, directly and through his spokesperson, has said that he's not going to get mired in the conflict between the Senate Intelligence Committee and his appointed CIA director, John Brennan. But in your view, what is the president's role here in getting this information revealed to the public in terms of the policies that led to torture, which is illegal under the U.S., illegal under U.S. law as well as international law? What could or should he be doing at this point?
Mm-hmm. Well, what he should be doing is what he should have done 5 years ago and pursued these gross violators of international and national law. But that would have meant going up the line to a fellow named George W. Bush, Dick Cheney, a series of attorneys general who are all implicated in this. And Obama is not the kind of guy who's going to take this task on. You could say he's weak. I think he's afraid. And, you know, my attitude to that is if you're going to be this toady, if he's going to be this afraid, if, for example, he really thinks that he and his family are in physical danger from these folks, which I have reason to believe he does feel, then he shouldn't have tried to be president. Because you can't run a government if you're afraid of your own security sources, your own security organs. And he gives every evidence to me of being afraid of John Brennan, of General Keith Alexander, the head of NSA, and, of course, of James Clapper, former general, who now is the National Intelligence Director. Clapper lied under oath exactly a year ago, 12th of March, 2013. He said, no, the NSA is not spying, is not collecting any manner of information on any Americans. Well, he threw his teeth. Later, he apologized to the Senate and said, well, I said something that was clearly erroneous, and I'm really sorry. Well, hello, he's still head of national intelligence. So, you know, it's a no-brainer to me that Obama doesn't want to fight anybody, and it seems to me what will happen here is that he'll arrange the kind of beer summit. Do you remember when that professor up there in Harvard was harassed by the Boston police, and they all came down, they had a beer with Joe Biden and Obama, and they sat around it and made nice, okay? Well, my guess is they'll have a wine summit this time because Feinstein is from California out there in the wine country. They'll all sit down, Brennan and Feinstein and Joe Biden, of course, and the president, and they'll all make nice and paper this whole thing over because the president, I guess I'll just say it in Bronx, okay, that's where I'm from, the president has no guts. And were he to develop a backbone, then he might be able to gain control of his security services, but he doesn't right now. And I checked with the doctors at GW University Hospital, and they say that they're at least 3 years away from a backbone implant, and so there's no hope for Obama getting a backbone in the interim. Meanwhile, you have the CIA pretty much unrestrained. You have them supervising the Senate Select Committee on Intelligence rather than vice versa, and the situation has not been this bad since the 70s. Last time it was divulged that everybody was spying on everybody else, including Americans, and not only that, there were assassinations going on and all kinds of other stuff. So there were laws passed then, but after 9/11, everything changed. The laws thrown out the window, illegal laws introduced. You know, people say, McGovern, come on now. Here we go. Oh, that's an oxymoron. Well, it ain't an oxymoron.
Ray, I just wanted to, because we're going to run out of time here quickly, and I wanted to get a question to you on Ukraine. But before we leave the subject of the CIA, during the 70s, Congress convened the Church Committee, which did expose a lot of the wrongdoing wrongdoing by the CIA. Is it time for another church committee to be formed, given what's come out in the open, these allegations of spying on Congress?
I agree. The only problem is, if you look at the Congress, I'm hard-pressed to find a senator of the caliber and courage of the Frank Church. So, yeah, that's clearly what needs to happen. But, you know, I'd be very happy to have it happen, but doesn't look like anything like that is in the offing. Things will continue to fester, and more and more people will get more people in trouble, but not accountable.
Ray, just a last question while we have some time here. There's a lot of talk about a new Cold War with Russia's apparent intervention in Crimea and the probable annexation of that territory, barring any negotiated settlement that leads to a different outcome. But in brief here, what are your concerns about the current situation and the tensions with Russia?
Well, Scott, what happened here, it was totally predictable. The Russians are terribly sensitive to the encroachment by NATO into their backyard. They made that clear right after the Soviet Union imploded. They told actually James Baker, the Secretary of State for George H.W. Bush, look, we have 20 divisions in East Germany, but the wall is down. We're going to withdraw those divisions. And, okay, we can live with a reunited Germany. We can even allow it to remain a part of NATO. But look, here's the deal. No more countries picked off to join NATO, okay? There's the deal. Jim Baker said it's a deal. They shook on it. Clinton comes in, and all of a sudden, all these East European countries, including some in the Baltic, which used to be part of the Soviet Union, not satellites, they're picked off one by one, and they become part of NATO. Ukraine is a bridge too far, okay? And what we had on the 22nd of February was one regime change too far. We know that the U.S. was involved in that regime change. Putin is not going to stand for that. And, you know, he feels tricked with good reason. And he's not going to permit the emplacement of a NATO country in his right backyard there in Ukraine. So the sooner Obama comes to his senses and gets some good advice from people who know something about Russia and something about Russian history and the Russian strategic outlook, and realize that the Crimea has always been part of Russia since Catherine the Great in the 1700s, okay? So in a matter of speaking, it's the Crimea rejoining Russia. It's predominantly Russian right now, and it was always pretty much under Russian control with the naval bases and the air bases that they had there in Simferopol and then the naval base. So what's going to happen here is, I hope, mature adult people will come on the scene and say, look, let's work things out the way we used to. Let's get together. Let's create conditions where there can be a united Ukraine, east and west, and it won't be fiercely hostile to either Russia or to the EC. And let's support it economically so that it can draw on the immense natural resources in Ukraine and not just fold it into the EC to become like Greece, subservient to the IMF, to the World Bank, to the Wall Street bankers. So that's what's got to happen. But Obama's got to step back, and so does Putin, and they need to talk about these things. The good news is they were able to do that with Syria. I think it'll take a couple weeks, but I think they'll be able to do that again, despite the people who actually wish for a more Serbic relationship between the U.S. and Russia. Those are the people who resent Putin helping us out on Syria, helping us out on Iran. They don't like that, and that's one reason why they helped to incite this putsch that successfully overthrew the duly elected government of Ukraine.
Right. You wouldn't be talking about Senator John McCain, would you? No, that it's clear that he's a guy who is hard to find a war he doesn't want to fight, or send somebody else to fight, I should say.
Well, you know, the Assistant Secretary of State for European Affairs, Victoria Nuland, was passing out chocolate chip cookies there on Independence Square,
right.
Just a couple of days before the snipers started shooting at the cops, at the police, as well as at the demonstrators. Why were there 80 people killed? Because the snipers were shooting at both sides. We know that. That came from an intercepted message. So who has the incentive? Who has the incentive to create the kind of violence that succeeded in dethroning or removing the elected government? Well, they're the people that would like to see the Ukraine part of NATO, part of the World Bank or the banking system of the EC, and who want to see enmity, a resurgence of the Cold War-type hostility between the United States and Russia. And so far, they've made some steps towards succeeding, but I think Obama is smart enough that he'll get enough people telling him which end is up now. And he'll back off, and he'll say, all right, we did trick you back there in 1990. We told you there'd be no NATO encroachment, and there is. We'll stop here, and we'll work out something so that we can both live with a united Ukraine that is not hostile to either side.
Well, Ray, thanks so much for spending time with us tonight. Is there a place you would send our listeners to read some of your articles?
Sure. My son created a website for me. It's very easy. RayMcGovern.com.
All right. Well, we'll re-announce that later. But I do appreciate you spending time with us to clarify some of these issues from the point of view of someone who's had a long career in the CIA. So thanks again, Ray, and happy St. Patty's Day.
And the same to you.
All right. Thanks. Take care, Rick. Good night.
Okay. Bye.
That's Ray McGovern, retired 27-year veteran CIA officer and someone who's the founder of Veteran Intelligence Professionals for Sanity, who's quite an activist in his own right and works with many other retired CIA officers. We're going to take a break here on WPKN and Bridgeport, 89.5 FM, for some music and be back with a discussion of energy issues in Ukraine. So do stay with us. We'll be back in just a moment.
I turned on my TV, though it was hard to see these men who would be head of state. What a great country, from sea to shining sea, we watched the Republicans debate. Newt stood with his third wife and said, you bet your life, the president is a red. He wants to tax the rich a lot, take your limo and your yacht. He wants to have the bankers' heads. But if he gets in again, he'll paint the White House pink, and then he'll hire Chavez as his VP. Then we'll be right on track to give capitalism the sack, along with the insurance industry. If only it were true, if only it were true, I'd be so happy, wouldn't you? If only it were true, if only it were true, if only it were true. He'll give everyone food stamps and wheelchair ramps. He'll subsidize windmills and maple syrup. He'll cripple industries with eco-friendly policies, and pretty soon we will be just like Europe. He'll shut down oil wells and deliver solar cells to each home in Delaware and Illinois. He'll ban logging in the parks. He'll send the works of Karl Marx to the homes of every American girl and boy. He'll abolish pesticides. He'll be giving out free rides and free lunches, too, in his high-speed trains. He'll start lots of public works full of union perks. He'll fill all the cities up with bicycle lanes. If only it were true, if only it were true, I'd be so happy, wouldn't you? If only it were true, if only it were true, if only it were true.
Music from David Rovics here on WPKN in Bridgeport. My name is Scott Harris, here Monday evenings with Counterpoint, and we're very happy to welcome to our program our next guest. That's Kenneth Bassong. He's executive director of the Sunday Campaign, a nonprofit research and educational group that promotes sustainable energy technologies as cost-effective alternatives to both nuclear power and fossil fuels. Ken served as a Peace Corps volunteer at the Ukrainian Academy of Public Administration from 2000 to 2003. And I'm very happy you could join us tonight, Ken.
Happy to be with you.
So, as many of our listeners who are tracking the news are very well aware, the day after an overwhelming and controversial vote deemed illegal by countries, including our own, citizens in Crimea Sunday voted to split from Ukraine and join the Russian Federation. Crimea's recently installed parliament moved to nationalize the assets of Ukraine's state-owned properties, including the oil companies. Crimean officials say they may sell the energy companies to Russia's largest oil corporation, Gazprom. And while the U.S. and European Union finalized plans to impose economic sanctions on Russia for the military incursion and occupation and possible annexation of Crimea, the issue of energy is pivotal in how this crisis will play out, in the opinion of many. And I wonder, Ken, as we begin this discussion, maybe you could explain to our audience the role Ukraine plays as the crossroads of Russian pipelines that bring, from what I hear, one-third of all Russian oil and gas to Europe, as well as Ukraine's dependency on Russian energy sales.
Well, what you said is correct. Just to expand on that, it is true that about a third of the oil and gas that go into the EU comes from Russia through pipeline network that crisscrosses Ukraine. What's important to also realize, however, is that the oil and gas that comes to those pipelines accounts for only about a quarter of the energy that's being used in the EU. The EU also relies on sources of their own and imports from other places. So in reality, the energy coming through Ukraine to the EU accounts maybe 6 to 8% of the total energy used in the European Union. Significant, but not overwhelming. And that's important just because, to the extent that energy is being used as a political weapon, it's not as significant a weapon as many people are concerned that it could be. As far as Ukraine itself is concerned, Ukraine, due to a host of very bad political decisions made since independence 22 years ago, has remained heavily dependent on Russia, not only for oil and gas, but also for nuclear fuel. Approximately 60 to 70% of the natural gas consumed in Ukraine comes from Russia. A roughly comparable percentage of its oil also comes from Russia. And fully all of the nuclear fuel used in the country's nuclear power plants is enriched in Russia. So Ukraine is very heavily dependent on Ukrainian gas, Ukrainian oil, and Ukrainian nuclear fuel. Doesn't have to be. Ukraine is one of the most energy inefficient countries in Europe. By comparison, for example, Ukraine uses twice as much energy per unit of GDP as does its neighbor Poland. And I've done calculations in the past which indicate that if Ukraine, through efficiency measures, simply reduced its energy use to the same level as Ukraine, it could actually eliminate fully 100% of all the imports from Russia and from most other sources.
Well, Ken, given the dependency of Ukraine on Russian energy sources and Europe's significant reliance on Russian energy, how do you see that playing into any possible negotiation and settlement here of this crisis that came out of Russia's incursion and occupation of Crimea, and then the subsequent referendum voting overwhelmingly, to become part of the Russian Federation, although, of course, that referendum being branded as illegal by Western nations.
Well, Russia is not in the position where it can immediately cut off, if it chose to, the energy supplies in Ukraine for a couple of reasons. Notwithstanding its dependence on Russian oil and gas, Ukraine does produce some percentage of its own oil and gas. It produces about 25% of its own natural gas, for example. But more importantly, it has significant storage capabilities, and it has been stockpiling natural gas for a while. The exact amount of gas it has in storage or is able to produce over the next year is subject to some debate. But most guesses that I've seen, most estimates, suggest that Ukraine could survive on what it currently has and will be able to produce for at least another year. So that gives it a window of opportunity in which to make some very dramatic, very fast, but nonetheless effective changes in its energy use patterns. Again, the country is extremely inefficient in its energy use, and there are a lot of low-hanging fruit in the form of ways of reducing energy waste in the country, ranging from simple things like improving the efficiency of buildings, changing out light bulbs, changing transportation patterns, where the country could reduce very quickly a significant portion of the energy it now wastes so that it's in a better bargaining position in a year's time in terms of dealing with Russia on this problem. It's also very possible that the EU could, depending on a number of factors, assist Ukraine both with technology and with supply, again, given that it's got a year's time in which to make a switch. It can't obviously go independent in 12 months' time, but it can certainly reduce greatly the dependency it currently has on Russia.
We're speaking with Kenneth Bassong. He's executive director of the Sunday Campaign, and we're talking to Ken about Ukraine and the energy situation there, which has a lot to do with how this conflict may play out. Ken, the U.S. response to the crisis in Ukraine has seen politicians in Washington calling for the speeding up the construction of liquid natural gas export terminals on American East and West coasts. Further, there's talk about helping the Ukraine government exploit shale oil deposits underground there. Is what we're hearing out of Washington and from some big oil companies a real solution to problems there, or is it really just exploiting the current crisis to speed up permits to do things that may not have been possible otherwise to ram through the permitting process?
The proposals that are coming from the oil and gas companies in the United States are not completely ridiculous, but they should be taken with a very large grain of salt for a whole host of reasons, which I'll mention. If you read the media in the United States very superficially, you would be led to believe that the United States has a surplus of oil and gas that we could ship over to Europe or to Ukraine to help in the current crisis. And that is factually not correct. The United States is a net importer of both natural gas and oil. We currently import about a third of our oil and between 5 and 6% of our natural gas. If we were to export some of our domestically produced resources, that would mean we would have to import oil and gas from other sources to replace it. In effect, what we'd be doing is selling our domestic supplies at a low price and importing it at a high price. And it makes no economic sense to sell low and buy high, which is what we would end up doing. More importantly, however, physically it's not possible to get natural gas, at least directly, to Ukraine using LNG. There are no LNG facilities currently in Ukraine. Ukraine had been exploring building one or more on the Black Sea, but it has not yet done so. So there's no place for us to actually export natural gas directly into Ukraine. Moreover, if an LNG facility was to be built, it would almost certainly have to be built on the Black Sea, which effectively now is a war zone because Russia has invaded Crimea. It's also actually invaded into Ukraine proper, into an area called Kherson, and building an LNG facility in what is, if not a fighting zone, a potential war zone, is at best risky, if not just plain foolish. Another concern is that even if an LNG facility could be built, the gas would have to go through the Strait of Bosphorus that is controlled by Turkey. And Turkey is basically saying no for two reasons. One, the straits are currently over prescribed for ships trying to go through, and Turkey has a particular concern with allowing natural gas, liquefied natural gas, to go through the straits because it's a safety factor. So you'd have to negotiate with Turkey to even change its policies before you can get gas into an LNG facility that doesn't yet exist in Ukraine. There may be some option for shipping American gas to Europe and utilize one of the LNG facilities in Europe, but then that would mean that the gas would have to go to Ukraine by reversing the flow in the gas pipelines that crisscross Europe. Right now the gas goes from east to west, and we would have to instead then have the pipelines reverse the flow from west to east. It's technically doable, but nonetheless it is an additional barrier to accomplishing that. So for all those reasons, certainly in the short term, it's not practical. Economically, it's questionable. Long term, it may not be doable as well. And if you have to make a choice, it would make more sense if we're talking about the next 6, 12 months, 2 years, to invest heavily in getting Ukraine to reduce its dependence on natural gas rather than trying to get new supplies into the country.
Ken, maybe you can discuss for our audience a bit about the potential of fracking in Ukraine and other parts of Europe, where I've read there's been public resistance to moving ahead with some of these dangerous practices that have been widely criticized about pollution emanating from fracking wells and such. Is this another case of U.S. and international oil companies taking advantage of the current crisis to push policies that would otherwise not have a lot of support?
Not necessarily. I'm somewhat agnostic on fracking. Fracking has some very decided environmental risks. Among them are pollution of underground water supplies, and also seismic disruptions. And there is the use of chemicals which are not always publicly disclosed that could be toxic. However, fracking can, if carefully regulated, be done in a relatively safe manner. Ukraine does not have the legal system in place to ensure that fracking is done safely, so that's one concern. Second is that the locations where U.S. and other companies have been exploring in Ukraine to do fracking include some of the most ecologically fragile parts of the country, such as the Carpathian Mountains, and there would be strong resistance for good reason to doing fracking in those areas. A third concern is that fracking is not a guarantee of success. It's simply a process of exploration, and there has been some significant exploration in Poland, Ukraine's next-door neighbor, which has ended up with some effectively what we'd call dry wells. So fracking is a possibility if done well, but it's no guarantee, and there's not the infrastructure, the legal infrastructure, to ensure that it can be done well in Ukraine. And finally, one of the question marks about fracking would be whether it could be done in areas where there's not a risk of, again, military action. Again, one of the places that Ukraine has been considering as a site for fracking has been the Carpathian Mountains, which is away from the likely potential war zone. But other sections are in southeastern Ukraine, which is now being threatened by Russian invasion. So even if there were resources there, it's questionable whether you can get access to them, and you certainly wouldn't want to develop them and then have them seized by Russia.
We're speaking with Kenneth Balsong, Executive Director of the Sunday Campaign. And Ken, having lived in the Ukraine for several years, maybe you could speak to what we've read about some of the endemic corruption that has been found among government officials of both parties when it comes to signing energy contracts for the sale of gas and oil and such. It seems to be a feature of political life in Ukraine that a lot of money flows to the pockets of politicians from all these parties that have occupied the presidency in recent years.
That's probably an understatement. Ukraine's corruption is floating on natural gas to a very large degree. One of the people who has been in opposition in recent years and was recently released from jail is the former Prime Minister Yulia Tymoshenko, whose nickname is the Gas Princess, because she gained her wealth through manipulations, perhaps legal, but nonetheless manipulations in the natural gas market following Ukraine's independence. And many of the figures in the just-deposed Yanukovych government had their fingers, again, in the gas market in ways that are still not yet publicly known. But it's clear that manipulation of gas prices has been a feature of Ukraine's government since independence. More importantly, Ukraine, independent or separate from the issue of corruption, has had a illogical system of heavily subsidizing its natural gas use. It buys gas at the highest prices from Russia in all of Europe, and then it subsidizes the prices to its industries and to its individual citizens, so there's no incentive to economize or to invest in energy efficiency, and as a consequence, very, very large volumes of natural gas are consumed at very, very high prices, which means that a large percentage of Ukraine's GDP is in the form of gas purchases, making the industry inefficient and non-competitive and making it very, very difficult for the country to invest in other social services, whether it be roads or schools or hospitals.
Now, the interim government in Kiev, from what I understand, is negotiating loan guarantees from the International Monetary Fund, the U.S. and the European Union. And part of that requires this new government in Ukraine to impose austerity measures like we've seen unfold in Greece and Spain and Portugal and other places. And one of the issues, as you just referred to, is to end a lot of the subsidies, a lot of the energy subsidies that go to citizens of Ukraine. What kind of shock is that likely to cause to people who depend on cheap gas to heat their homes or gasoline to fuel their cars if all of a sudden these prices skyrocket?
Depends on how it's done. There are no consistent figures that I have seen as to what the actual amount of subsidies for natural gas in the country are. However, one economist who I respect about a week ago suggested that about $4 billion is spent per year in Ukraine to subsidize gas for both industry and individuals, with roughly three-quarters going to industries that don't need the subsidies and one-quarter perhaps going to the general population. And Ukraine's population is quite poor across the board. If simply the three-quarters that's going to the industry that doesn't need these subsidies was eliminated, that would go a long way to changing the dynamic in the country in terms of how energy is bought and sold and used. It would make sense as a transition to continue but slowly phase out the subsidies to the general population while you're trying to do things like improve the energy efficiency of their buildings and their schools and their hospitals, so that ultimately the amount of money that a person pays for energy stays about the same, but they're using it more efficiently. And I think the IMF, which is the main body that's been pushing for the phase-out of subsidies, would be comfortable with that. What the IMF is looking for from Ukraine is a defined and enforceable calendar of steps whereby Ukraine phases out its subsidies and adapts itself to a more realistic program of real-world energy prices.
Well, Ken, just a final question here. The fossil fuels seem to be playing a central role in the political conflict in Ukraine, at least in part. What are some alternative energy policies that could be pursued in both Ukraine and other nations in Europe to reduce tensions and the production of greenhouse gases that are linked to climate change?
Well, just to give you a few statistics, Ukraine is the largest country in Europe other than the Russian Federation. It has a very large landmass. However, in terms of its energy consumption, only about 2, maybe 3% of its energy comes from renewable sources, by which I mean hydropower, biomass, solar, wind, geothermal. In the electrical sector, about 6.5 or 7% of the electricity in the country comes from renewables. But Ukraine has probably the best resource base of any country in Europe, at least not including the Russian Federation, for renewables. For example, it has more solar radiation than does Germany, even though Germany is the world's leader in solar use right now. It has wind resources that are economically developable in about 40% of the land area. It has the largest potential for biomass, probably of any country in Europe. It has hundreds and arguably thousands of unused small hydroelectric sites. And it has a very large geothermal base in several sections of the country, which is completely undeveloped. Europe, meaning the European Union, is on track to get about 20% of its energy and electricity from renewables by the year 2020. There is no reason Ukraine could not be following and exceeding the same targets. However, it's not. And that's one area that can be developed and can be acted on in a fairly short period of time, particularly because the cost for most renewables now is becoming competitive with fossil fuels and certainly with nuclear power. However, as I said earlier, Ukraine is the most energy inefficient country in all of Europe, and the potential for vast and very quick and low cost gains in improved energy efficiency are vast. The country, again, could reduce its energy use theoretically by half in the space of maybe 5, 10, 15 years with the right policies.
Well, Ken, before we say goodnight, why don't you say a word about your organization's Sunday campaign, and certainly provide the website, too, so people can know a little bit more about it.
Well, as you said in the introduction, we are a nonprofit organization founded in 1993. Our focus is promoting efficiency and renewables primarily in the United States, but we do also work internationally with a special emphasis on Ukraine. Most of our work is in the form of publications. We do some work with the Congress and the administration. We are currently focusing on trying to document the near-term potential of a cross-section of renewable energy technologies that can be developed quickly in the United States. We don't have a web page. Email address, though, is sun-day-campaign@hotmail.com.
Okay. Well, I appreciate you spending time with us tonight to talk about these issues in Ukraine that relate to energy, which in part, of course, relates to the larger crisis we're seeing unfold there. So, Ken, thanks so much, and we'll look forward to checking in with you again about some of these same issues in the future. Thanks.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you. Good night. That's Kenneth Bassong, Executive Director of the Sunday Campaign, talking about some of the energy issues intersecting with the crisis in Ukraine. It's about 1 minute before 9 p.m., and this is WPKN in Bridgeport, 89.5 FM. And we hope you'll stick around. We've got more coming up. Discussion. In just a few moments, we're going to be talking about issues having to do with the minimum wage and the differential with Wall Street, gargantuan Wall Street bonuses, and the differential effect of stimulus to the greater U.S. economy. That's going to be coming up in a little while. And next up, I'm trying to remember what we got next up, but we'll have it in just a moment. I've got to make the call here. So while we do that, let's listen to some music. This is something called Digging in the Dirt, maybe relating to our discussion about energy issues and fracking and the like. That's our next topic. We're going to be talking about a campaign at National Public Radio to stop the network from taking money from the petroleum companies trying to push fracking all over the country. So that's the next thing up, and we'll hope you'll stay tuned for that. This is WPKN in Bridgeport, 89.5 FM.
sticky. All the time it's getting strong. The way you're dealing with this feeling can't go on, that is too long. This time you've gone too far. This time you've gone too far. This time you've gone too far. I told you. This time you've gone too far. This time you've gone too far.
This is WPKN in Bridgeport, 89.5 FM, and the program is Counterpoint. We're here Mondays between 8 and 10. We're glad you could stop by. You can find archives of this and many other programs on this station at WPKN.org. Just click on the archive button, and Counterpoint also has its own archive at the CounterpointRadio.org website. And lastly, I'll mention the syndicated show we produce each week called Between the Lines Radio News Magazine, and you can find audio interviews there stretching back many years at the btlonline.org website. You can subscribe to free podcasts, interview transcripts, and program summaries every week that are brought to you there, and that's btlonline.org. And I also want to just make sure to thank everybody who supported this station in our recently concluded British Invasion Fund Drive. It was a lot of fun, and a lot of people stepped up to make contributions, and I thank you for all for that. And right now I'm very happy to welcome to our program Drew Hudson, Executive Director of the group Environmental Action. Drew, thanks for being here tonight.
Thanks for having me.
Drew, tell our listeners a bit about the group Environmental Action. I think you guys started way back in 1970, is that right?
We did. We were born right out of the first Earth Day. The founders at Environmental Action were some of the folks who helped plan the first Earth Day teach-ins and rallies around the country. And we've been around since 1970 pushing for clean air and clean water. And we're originally best known in D.C. for a series of ads we did calling up members of Congress who voted against some early environmental laws like the Endangered Species Act and the Clean Water Act. Called the Dirty Dozen. We'd take out newspaper ads and sort of make fun of them for being against an idea as obvious as the planet. And these days we keep with that spirit, though times have changed, and we're making fun lately of NPR and them for talking about why natural gas fracking is such a good idea when in fact it's so very bad for the planet.
This is a fascinating campaign you've launched there at Environmental Action. It's I think the name of it, and you can correct me, is Don't Even Think About It. It's really targeting National Public Radio to urge them to stop taking corporate sponsorship funding from the American Natural Gas Alliance, which is using its underwriting airtime to promote hydraulic fracturing, natural gas drilling methods, commonly known as fracking, across the United States. Maybe you can speak to how this campaign got underway, and as I understand, you got tens of thousands of signatures urging NPR to drop this funding source.
Indeed, yeah, it actually was the name of the campaign comes from the ads themselves that the Natural Gas Alliance took out. So the American Natural Gas Alliance was, as you say, a big sponsor of NPR programming, and they had been running these spots where they encouraged people to just think about natural gas, and they would say these wonderful sounding stories about how natural gas was saving the family farm and helping people be cleaner and better. And in fact, the truth about fracking, as dozens of communities all over the country know, is much, much dirtier. Fracking has been linked to, polluted groundwater, increased global warming pollution, increased dependence on fossil fuels. And just in the last week, there's been some incidents in Ohio of fracking actually causing earthquakes. So there's all these litany of really terrible problems. And here was NPR, of all places, a sort of trusted news source, repeating on air these terrible lies about how clean and safe the drilling technology was. And a group of members of ours got together and said, hey, we're NPR members and donors. We're really kind of angry that they're saying all this misleading stuff about fracking. Will you help us put together a campaign to get the attention of National Public Radio? And so that's where the petition campaign came from. As you say, over 45,000 people now have signed on asking NPR to drop the sponsorship from the Natural Gas Alliance and stop repeating these misleading statements on air. We actually took the signatures down to NPR's national headquarters in D.C. a couple of weeks ago in December, along with some fracking activists from Pennsylvania and other places, delivered them there and met with the ombudsman and the acting CEO of NPR. But to date, they haven't changed the policy. I mean, they've taken us seriously to some extent, but they haven't changed anything. So we're continuing to continue the campaign and put pressure on them to change their sponsorship and change these messages.
Well, I want to get into the particulars of NPR's coverage or lack of coverage of some of the concerns you have about fracking. But I wanted to you can review for our audience a bit about what we know in terms of scientific evidence about the hazards to human health as well as the environment that are produced by the hydraulic fracturing method of drilling for natural gas in and around areas of shale formations around the country.
Sure. Well, this is a relatively new technology, and it really wouldn't exist at all if it had to abide by the same kind of rules as other drilling technology does. Fracking comes about in the last probably 10 years or so, really, as a dominant drilling technology for gas and also for oil and other things because of a special loophole that was written into the Safe Drinking Water Act by none other than Dick Cheney. The loophole is nicknamed the Halliburton loophole because it was his old company, Halliburton, that really pushed for it. It basically allows the people employing this drilling technology to keep the chemicals they're using a complete secret from the public, from regulators, and from the media. So the real sort of Achilles heel of this drilling technology, or at least of our ability to understand it and understand all of its impacts on human health and the environment, is that they don't actually have to tell us what it is they're pumping into the ground. But even without knowing the precise details and scientific amounts of chemicals they're putting in the ground, this whole technology is just a crazy idea. They're basically mixing up water, a soup of toxic chemicals, and sand, and then they're pumping this stuff into the ground with enough pressure to shatter the bedrock and release these tiny little pockets of natural gas that are trapped in the shale formations around various parts of the country. It's a great way to get a little tiny bit of natural gas out of what would otherwise be an impossible amount of rock, but it's a really terrible idea for pretty much everybody else. As I say, they won't tell us what all the chemicals are, but there's no way that it can get them back out of the bedrock after they've shattered it open with these chemicals and sand. So some of those chemicals always stay behind. They leach into local aquifers and drinking water wells. And there was a big expose in the last year broken by the LA Times and ProPublica that the EPA, in fact, had early evidence that fracking was contaminating drinking water in several communities. We know at least three in Texas, Pennsylvania, and Wyoming, where drinking water had been contaminated by local fracking wells. And the EPA basically covered that research up under pressure from the White House and from members of Congress and other big political figures in D.C., and that kept the lid on the idea that fracking was a danger to drinking water for a long time. In addition, in just the last couple of months, we've seen a lot of really startling evidence that fracking, you know, just not ready for this technology. And so everything from the wellheads to the pipelines to the trucks that they are transporting the gas in are leaking, and they're leaking methane, which is a much more potent greenhouse gas than carbon dioxide or other kinds of global warming pollution. And so even though gas is often touted as a cleaner fuel, cleaner, not clean, but cleaner than coal, it's actually very bad for the climate because of all this leaking methane emissions. So the whole industry really from start to finish has been a very bad deal for the planet and a very bad deal for communities that have been nearby these fracking wells. And the only reason it's gotten away with it this long is because, again, under this Halliburton loophole, they haven't had to disclose a lot of the facts about what they're doing. They've been able to get away with the things that other drilling companies would never be allowed to do. And that's made it really hard on local communities. And we really rely on reporters and the press to get this information out, to go and dig behind the scenes for what's actually happening at fracking sites around the country. And NPR has just been doing a spectacularly bad job of digging into that story, many of us suspect, because they're getting so much money from the natural gas drillers.
Well, Drew, before we move on to some of the particulars about NPR, maybe you want to say a word or two about the ProPublica report about some very damaging pollution coming out of fracking wells in the state of Texas. It got some play in some of the local newspapers or national newspapers as well, but maybe you can speak to what this reveal, which is not only a hazard to people living in Texas, but speaks ill of the technology generally.
Absolutely, yeah. This is a really great piece of reporting, but really bad news, especially for these communities in Texas. There have been just huge amounts. Many of the communities that have lived around fracking wells for many years have known that there are serious impacts. And like I say, they've been struggling to get that story out, fighting against industry secrecy laws and all kinds of pushback from heavy political figures. ProPublica wrote this great piece and put up a great website that documented, one particular area in Texas, one of the real ground zeros of the fracking gold rush, and how really bad everything from air quality to water quality and all kinds of things that impact public health have gotten right around this one fracking site. And it's really indicative of what's going on in many communities around the country. The fracking industry comes in, they make big promises about money they're going to give to local schools or to local landowners. They promise that this will be clean and safe drilling. That's the kind of thing that they say in their ads on NPR. And the truth is really very different from that. As this story documented, the impacts on human health are just disastrous. Just from them doing business, the every piece of this industry of fracking is really very dirty, from the chemicals they pump into the ground to break the bedrock and get the gas out, to the way that they extract the gas, which is very leaky and tends to result in a lot of air pollution and also global warming pollution, to the way that they move the gas around, whether it's by pipeline or by truck. It tends to be very heavy industry, really bad impacts on local air and water quality, and really dangerous for the people who live nearby. And we've been working with communities all over the country, but especially in the three hotspots in Texas and in Wyoming and in Pennsylvania, are three places where the fracking industry has really come in and enforce, and where a lot of people are feeling the impacts of this drilling technology really strongly.
Well, thanks for that, Drew. In addressing the central topic here of NPR and its coverage of fracking, give our audience, if you would, some examples of what kinds of coverage NPR has been doing in terms of favorable news reports about fracking, and I think in your view, ignoring some of the negative science around fracking that people should know about.
Yeah, I mean, with NPR in particular, it's not so much a story of what they've been saying as what they haven't been saying. So when we went down and met with them in December, we brought several examples, and just in the couple of weeks since the holidays, there have been many more examples of where NPR will they're not saying anything that's untrue about fracking. They're just overlooking all the downsides, essentially. And in many cases, it's actually, an opportunity of the National Bureau really overlooking local stories. So we found a bunch of examples of where the Pennsylvania bureaus in particular had reported on local impacts of natural gas drilling, where they'd talked about some of the interviewed local people in communities who'd seen the impacts of contaminated well water, of living next to fracking sites and seeing some of these air pollution impacts and things like that. The local stations were picking it up, and the national NPR affiliates, the shows like All Things Considered and Morning Edition that get millions more listeners than the local NPR station does in Pennsylvania, were just completely not showing that story. And one of the biggest stories we think that they really missed in the last year is this story about the cover-up, really, at the EPA. You know, the EPA had swept its own research under the rug. They had damning conclusions that clearly indicated that fracking was probably the source of water pollution in these three communities in Wyoming, Texas, and Pennsylvania. And the Pennsylvania Bureau picked up the story when it turned out that thanks to whistleblowers in the Philadelphia office of the EPA, they leaked their own research, which they had been told not to share with the press. They gave it to reporters at ProPublica and at the LA Times and other places. And that formed bedrock of really being able to create a sort of smoking gun to show that fracking really was having these dramatic impacts on groundwater and that the EPA had known about it. And we found out later from subsequent reporting that, you know, the pressure to cover up that research probably came from very high up in both the White House and in Congress. And NPR was completely silent on that story, even as, you know, people from Dimmick, Pennsylvania were driving across the state to Philadelphia to deliver jugs of contaminated drinking water and stand in solidarity with the whistleblowers in their state at the EPA office. The local stations were picking up and the national stations were completely covering it up. And that was just one example of where we thought that NPR was really missing the story, despite all the clear reasons they should pick it up. It was their local bureaus doing the reporting. It's very clearly an interesting story that would impact a number of communities around the country and has to do with a huge national energy boom. I mean, this fracking is really the new gold rush going on in America. There are new wellheads opening every day. Fracking companies are out pushing communities from coast to coast to adopt this new drilling technology with very little disclosure and very little discussion of the real risks to the environment and to human health. And it's going to be up to news sources to tell the truth, because clearly the frackers aren't going to do it. And so far, at least, the administration and Congress have not been willing to adopt rules and regulations that would compel them to tell the truth about their impacts.
We're speaking on Counterpoint tonight with Drew Hudson, Executive Director of the group Environmental Action. And Drew, as you met with the NPR acting CEO, Paul Haga Jr., and the NPR ombudsman, what was your impression of their explanation for NPR's skewed coverage of fracking? Did you get the feeling that they were really just ignorant of some of these facts on the ground that their network should be reporting? Or did you get the impression that there's been a breach of the firewall between the fundraising arm of NPR and the news directors who make editorial decisions?
You know, I don't think it's as simple or as clear-cut as someone from the Natural Gas Alliance, you know, walking in with a suitcase full of unmarked bills or something like that. I don't think that's what's going on at NPR. But I do think that the sponsorship and then just the overall sort of news coverage, their approach to this fracking boom in America has really indicated a sort of soft touch. NPR is certainly not alone, but they have been a real leader in covering the idea of fracking as a boon to the economy and to jobs, and really not getting into the impacts on the environment, or if they do, just sort of mentioning it as a one-off thing. Another example of a story we brought them was a piece they had run that came out of the New York City Bureau, but which they aired nationally, which talked about how, you know, apartment buildings in New York City were essentially lowering their energy bills by switching to natural gas for heating. It's all a fine and well story, and it has to do with why natural gas prices are going down and how that impacts markets around the country. But it completely overlooked the fact that just, you know, a few hundred miles away in Pennsylvania, where that fracked gas was coming from, there's a huge fight going on over public health and the environment. Farms are being shut down. People are losing access to safe drinking water. Some towns have had to purchase their own drinking water as theirs has gotten contaminated by local fracking. And it's all happening against a backdrop in New York of a big political fight where Governor Cuomo is still deciding whether or not to adopt a moratorium or extend a permanent moratorium or ban on fracking in New York State, or allow that drilling technology to expand into New York, into the parts of the shale formation that run up the western side of his state. So again, it's, I don't think it's that NPR has been bought off per se, but certainly there's this obvious connection for many of us between these things that you hear, and especially on a place like NPR where the sponsored messages, it's not even like another announcer comes on or they break in with an ad or something like you'd normally see on television. It's actually, you know, the newscasters, the people who read you the news, then pause for a moment and then turn around and repeat this statement that's written by the Natural Gas Alliance about how clean and safe natural gas is and how great it is for the economy. And so when you hear those things follow one after the other, I think it's very clear the Natural Gas Alliance knows exactly what they're getting for their money. And if NPR isn't aware of the bias that they're creating or the appearance of impropriety they're creating with their coverage, then they really need to be. And when we met with them, I think it's correct to say that the ombudsman and the CEO, the people we met with who are, you know, outside of the news department, were surprised. They didn't know about the stories we were telling them. They hadn't considered the coverage that we've been talking about. But I think that, you know, the claim of ignorance only lasts so long. We sat down with these guys in December. Since then, it has been complete silence from them. Just a few weeks ago, attempting to be in contact with the ombudsman's office again, basically was shut out of meeting with them or having a phone conversation with the ombudsman a second time. So it seems pretty clear that, you know, they might have feigned ignorance the first time, but at this point, they know what's going on. They've heard our concerns, and at this point, they're choosing not to change their approach or their coverage.
Drew, there was a quote that I read in a summary of your meeting with the NPR CEO and ombudsman, and it was something to the effect of announcer, I think it was Steve Inskeep, saying, quote, "Learn how a farmer in Ohio has helped support his family farm with the production of natural gas on his land." And that's part of an underwriting announcement, as you just mentioned, that's the words spoken by their news hosts, right?
Correct. And we discovered a really, in the course of this campaign, we found a really interesting double standard at the way NPR underwriting works. One of the things our members wanted to do, as I said, many of them were donors and members of local NPR affiliates. And so as the campaign was building and we crossed 30,000 signatures late last year, a group of members got together and said, hey, you know, why don't we put our own sponsored message on? If the fracking industry can get on Morning Edition and say natural gas is clean, why can't we at least get on with our own sponsored message and say, you know, consider the real facts? And as you say, the name of our campaign is NPR Don't Even Think About It, because we want them to really consider the truth of the argument. When we went to do that, though, we discovered a remarkable thing, which is our sponsorship. We wanted to try and sponsor a message on WNYC, which is the largest NPR affiliate in the country, though it's not the same thing as the national NPR corporate brand that produces Morning Edition and All Things Considered and those kind of shows. But when we went to get our ad on air, the local stations told us they would never accept the kind of sponsored messages that the Natural Gas Alliance pays for every day. Even saying the word fracking to them was considered too much advocacy to be put on a public radio station. And so our original message, which really was just a mirror of the Natural Gas Alliance's message, we wanted people to go to NPRDon'tEvenThinkAboutIt.org and consider the real impacts of fracked gas. That was considered out of bounds by the lawyers at WNYC, and they pushed us to edit the ad in a way that didn't talk about natural gas and didn't talk about fracking, because those would all be seen as advocacy statements that are not allowed by the national broadcast regulators for a public radio station. Those rules don't apply to the Natural Gas Alliance's sponsorship of shows on the national airwaves. If you're paying for content that goes alongside these big shows, All Things Considered and Morning Edition, you get to play by a different set of rules. And it only happens if you have millions of dollars to spend in sponsorship. It only happens if you are the biggest corporations with the most money to spend on the public airwaves. But if you have that kind of money like the Natural Gas Alliance does, then you're free to throw around some pretty misleading claims, and nobody will challenge you on it because it's going under the seal of this very trusted brand of national public radio. And that really was one of the key messages we wanted the ombudsman to hear, was that they are being used, their national brand is being used by people in the fracking industry to mislead the public, and that they can only get away with it in this particular way by sponsoring with big money on the big national programs.
Well, that double standard is just sticks out like a sore thumb as being wrong. You know, the regulations, the internal regulations at NPR obviously are deeply flawed, as you describe them. And what was the reaction to calling attention to that double standard when you met with the NPR ombudsman and the CEO there?
Well, not surprisingly, they're very loath to turn their back on a very steady supply of funding. You know, National Public Radio relies on donors, large and small, and many of them corporate, for the larger ones. And so they were, you know, pretty clear with us up front. They were not going to turn down money from the Natural Gas Alliance. But they were receptive to the idea that, combined with the stories they're not telling and the way that they're telling the stories they are about the fracking industry, that it's creating this sort of appearance of impropriety. So we really do hope that NPR will take that to heart. I don't have a lot of hope that they will actually turn around and return all the money to the Natural Gas Alliance. That, I think, would be the most honorable or ethical thing for them to do. But I do hope that they would reconsider the kind of messages they allow the Natural Gas Alliance to say on their airwaves, and that they compel their spokespeople and newscasters to repeat on the air. And I certainly hope it would make them reconsider the way that they cover fracking, again, if only to avoid the appearance that they are accepting money in exchange for news coverage. You know, that they should really change the stories that they broadcast and the way that they report on the fracking industry as a whole.
Well, Drew Hudson, I wanted to ask you a bit about commercial networks as before we say goodnight, but do tell our listeners how they can get involved in this NPR campaign regarding their coverage of fracking.
Sure. Well, everyone is welcome to go to the website nprdonteventhinkaboutit.org, where we have a petition up about asking NPR to reject the money from the fracking industry and to come clean about the influence of natural gas on the public airwaves. Everyone can sign up there, and I certainly hope they will. Over 45,000 people have so far. You're also welcome to visit environmental-action.org. We've got lots more updates about fracking's impacts all around the country, about news coverage, not just on NPR, but on other networks and on cable news, about how they're covering the story of fracking's impacts on communities and the environment, and lots more environmental issues besides. So come visit us online, and there's lots folks can do to get involved.
Well, Drew, just on that last note about some of the commercial networks, be they broadcast television or cable TV, I'm sure many of our listeners have experienced the nausea of seeing ad after ad after ad on television for these a myriad sort of propaganda from the petroleum corporations out there, the National Petroleum Institute and a whole host of other similar organizations, but they almost seem to have a monopoly, particularly on news channels, where they're almost the sole sponsor for some of these programs. What can you tell us about your findings about the effect of that advertising money flowing to some of these the media corporations and their coverage of fracking?
Yeah, well, like with NPR, on almost all of these stations, you know, you find a similar sort of pattern. I don't think it's as simple anywhere as, the Petroleum Institute or Natural Gas Alliance or any of these guys walking in with a bundle of cash and requesting the news coverage they would prefer. But certainly there seems to be a chilling effect. I mean, if you look at one of our partners, Media Matters, did a great report just a few weeks ago about the coverage of climate change on the major cable networks and on the Sunday morning shows on the networks over the last couple of years. And issues like climate change and the impact of fracking on groundwater and local environments, these things receive, you know, mere minutes of coverage a year. The amount of time and attention that's spent in most news networks paying attention to global climate change, to the environmental impact of these extractive industries, and to our increasingly frail dependence on more and more extreme forms of fossil fuels, whether it's fracking for natural gas or drilling for oil in the Arctic, or the fight going on in the Ukraine over how to ship gas from Russia to Europe. These things get more and more sort of tedious and tightly balanced, and yet the news networks blow right by all of those impacts and report only on the sort of economic boom, and they talk about it as a real impact on jobs and the economy, and these are really only one small part of the broader story about fossil fuel reliance. So we'd encourage folks to get outside of the major news networks and come to smaller local broadcasting stations. Often have much better and more accurate stories on local impacts of drilling and other kinds of extractive industries. And then go online and find people like Media Matters and like Environmental Action who are trying to get the real story out about climate change's impacts, and also about how the media is and isn't covering the truth of that. There's a lot of great stuff out there for people to read and find attention to. And as we mentioned, there are great news sources out there like ProPublica that will break really big stories, but you won't find them on the major news networks. You'll have to go dig on the internet to find them.
Well, Drew, I really want to applaud your campaign. From my own point of view, I think it's great to call the media, particularly quote-unquote public media, when they obviously have a blind spot, or, you know, deliberately or not, on this important issue of human health and environmental safety with this technology of fracking. So thanks for being here. Thanks for really spearheading this effort to call, you know, for accountability with NPR and the other stations as well. But do one more time leave our listeners with the website to get information on the NPR campaign.
Absolutely, and thanks for having us on. The website, if you want to find out more about the NPR fracking campaign, is nprdonteventhinkaboutit.org. And you can find out more about fracking in general and all of our campaigns at environmental-action.org.
All right. Well, thanks, Drew. Appreciate you spending time with us tonight. Thanks a lot.
Thank you so much. Have a good night.
You too. Bye-bye. That's Drew Hudson, Executive Director of the group Environmental Action, talking about their NPR Don't Even Think About It.org campaign. So we hope you'll visit that site. And we'll be back in just a moment. A little music and a message coming up before we talk about inequality with Sarah Anderson. Stay tuned. Year, the Gandhi Peace Award recognizes peace heroes whose sacrifices bring the world we dream of just a little closer.
Don't miss the presentation of the Gandhi Peace Award Wednesday, April 16th in New Haven to the nation's most renowned peace activist, Medea Benjamin, founder of Code Pink and Global Exchange.
For more than 30 years, she has advocated for peace and social justice, most recently bringing attention to the innocent people killed by U.S. drone weapons. President Obama has said of her, "We need to listen to that woman." Don't miss her stories of danger, courage, and imagination.
Promoting Enduring Peace has presented the award to Eleanor Roosevelt, Cesar Chavez, Daniel Ellsberg, Amy Goodman, Bill McKibben, and other great peace heroes. Don't miss this historic free event on Wednesday, April 16th at the United Church on the Green in New Haven, beginning at 7 p.m. To learn more, go to peepeace.org.
Should be a good event. I hope to be there myself to see Medea Benjamin, and we'll have her as a guest here before she comes to New Haven for that award in April. Right now, I'm very happy to welcome to our program Sarah Anderson, Global Economy Project Director with the Institute for Policy Studies based in Washington, D.C. Sarah, it's great to have you back in the program. Thanks for being here.
Really happy to be here.
So, Sarah, you're the author of a new report titled Wall Street Bonuses and the Minimum Wage, which finds that $26.7 billion, billion with a B, in bonuses given to employees in 2013 on Wall Street would be enough to more than double the pay of all the 1,085,000 full-time minimum wage workers across the United States who receive the minimum wage at just $7.25 an hour. Maybe you could tell us initially how this report came about and the initial goals in conducting your research on it.
Yeah, it came about because about a month ago I was listening to a segment on public radio where they were talking about how great the Wall Street bonuses are for the local economy because these Wall Street guys get all this money and then they throw it around, spending it on things like catering for fancy parties, and they buy new watches and all of this, and how it really boosts the local economy there in New York. And I heard that segment and I thought, hey, think about how much more bang for the buck we could get if that kind of money was going into the pockets of low-wage workers. Because low-wage workers tend to spend nearly every dollar that they make to meet basic needs, whereas the wealthy folks on Wall Street are in a much better position to squirrel away a lot of that money. And when you're spending money in your local community, it has ripple effects and adds more to our overall economy than if you're just hoarding it in your bank accounts. And so I not only, compared the overall size of the bonus pool to the earnings of minimum wage workers, I also looked at this different bang for the buck that you'd get. And if that same amount of money had gone into the pockets of minimum wage workers, the benefit to our national economy would have been more than three times as great.
Well, Sarah, that's important. And, I just wanted to take a step back because this, enormous amount of money, $26.7 billion in bonuses, that figure comes from, is it the New York State Attorney General? Is that right?
It's the New York State Comptroller.
Oh,
and the reason they collect it is because it is such a significant part of the economy there. And it does have a lot to do with the level of revenues that they are going to get in the city. And so I thought, with all the battles around the minimum wage, it was just a good hook for educating people a bit more about how vital these low-wage workers are to our economy and how much more they would be contributing if their wages increased.
And that figure of $26.7 billion is for New York State alone, is that correct?
Yeah, so people working for financial firms in, Chicago and elsewhere are not included in that. That's just the New York-based employees.
And I had read somewhere, I think it was your report, that this particular figure was up 15% in bonuses from the year before. Is that right?
Yeah, and it's the biggest since the financial crisis. It's as high as it was before the crash. So clearly, the Wall Street bonus culture has come roaring back. We're now about five and a half years after the crisis. And, of course, there's been some, slight upticks in the overall economy, but we still have about 3 million more people unemployed today than we had before the crash. So clearly, not everyone has fully recovered from that crisis, and yet the people who were at the forefront of creating it are back earning the big bonuses.
Sarah, as you said a moment ago, the report found that the stimulus effect of a boost in minimum wage workers' pay far exceeds that of generous bonuses paid to the already very wealthy stockbrokers and big-shot Wall Street players. But you quantified that in the report, right, in terms of an actual dollar figure that comes back into the economy with a stimulus effect, differentiating between one and the other.
Exactly. And I base this on kind of well-established, what they call multiplier effects. And basically what the real, you know, expert numbers crunchers and modelers say is that when it comes to a low-wage worker, every extra dollar you give them is going to add about $1.21 to the national economy because of those ripple effects, whereas every dollar given to a high-income person adds only about 39 cents to the domestic economy. And so if you took that big pile of Wall Street bonus money and gave it to low-wage workers, you could expect our economy to grow by about $32.3 billion, and that's more than three times as much as we can expect through the Wall Street bonus figures.
So, Sarah, how do you translate the conclusions of this research, as you just summarized there, into an action agenda on the U.S. economy? Mm-hmm. Because obviously Wall Street's not going to start giving out these bonuses to people on minimum wage salaries.
Right.
So
I'm not suggesting that.
Right,
but
right, I know.
I think that we have to address our extreme inequality at both ends. So on the bottom end, I'm very encouraged by all the energy around lifting up the minimum wage. I think we'll see some real wins there at the local, state, and maybe, who knows, even at the national level. I think the Senate will be voting on that in a month or so. But we also need to tackle this problem at the top end. And there were some small steps forward in the Dodd-Frank financial reform legislation. The problem is they haven't been implemented yet. So one of the provisions in Dodd-Frank said that regulators can prohibit Wall Street pay that encourages excessive risk. And now it's 4 years almost after the passage of Dodd-Frank, and that provision still has not been implemented yet. There's another part of Dodd-Frank that requires companies to report the gap between what their CEO and their worker makes. That also has not been implemented. The regulators have been dragging their feet in the face of very intense backlash, of course, from the corporate lobby groups, but still it is the law of the land, and it's really a scandal that we're coming up on the fourth anniversary of Dodd-Frank and those rules have not yet been enacted. And, you know, going beyond the modest things in Dodd-Frank, there's a lot more that needs to be done to rein in Wall Street. And just one idea I am a big fan of is the idea of putting a very small tax on each trade of stocks and derivatives and so forth. It's a way to both generate a lot of money that could go for things we all need, like better infrastructure and education and so forth, but it would also discourage the kind of really crazy high-speed trading that now dominates our markets and doesn't really add much to the economy.
And as far as the Dodd-Frank rules you're talking about that have not been implemented, maybe you can explain a little bit more about how these very lucrative bonuses encourage reckless behavior that risks not only, you know, a particular company's bottom line, but as we saw in the 2008 meltdown with the playing around with it within the derivative market and subprime mortgage securities, that we saw the whole global financial system collapse.
Yeah, they're dangerous because they incentivize risk. And so if a trader on Wall Street is very aggressive, takes, you know, huge risks with his strategies, he has everything to gain and basically nothing to lose. By the time a trade might blow up like we saw in 2008, he will have earned so much over the years in bonuses and commissions and so forth that in the end it's going to pay off for him. That's why we saw after the crash even a lot of people who were laid off temporarily as a result of that were off, you know, cavorting in very high-end resorts around the world because they had made so much money over so many years on these very reckless financial strategies that wound up pushing our economy over the cliff, but they had already made out very well on those. And so part of Dodd-Frank was trying to get at that. They have not been able to put those new rules in practice. And, you know, here we are more than 5 years after the crisis. Our too-big-to-fail banks are bigger than they were before the crisis, and it's worrisome.
Sarah Anderson is our guest, a Global Economy Project Director with the Institute for Policy Studies in Washington, D.C., and she's the author of the report we're talking about this evening, Wall Street Bonuses and the Minimum Wage. And Sarah, maybe you could talk a bit more about why those provisions within the Dodd-Frank legislation have not been implemented to discourage high-risk behavior on the part of these Wall Street traders.
Yeah, well, it's been a real shocker for me. I have to say, when I saw President Obama sign the law, I thought, okay, now we have this new law. All this has to happen. No. There's this whole long process that's called the rulemaking process where the different regulatory bodies have to figure out exactly how they're going to implement it. And with the one having to do with financial sector pay and making sure it doesn't encourage inappropriate risk, there are five different regulatory agencies, I think, that have to be involved and all come to an agreement on that. And in the meantime, they are being intimidated and bullied by the corporate lobby groups and the Wall Street lobby groups through any means that they can think of. They're threatening lawsuits, they're, flooding these agencies with comment letters saying that the sky is going to come crashing down. I mean, the most comical ones, I think, have to do with the new requirement to report their CEO to worker pay. I mean, this is just, it's a disclosure requirement. It's information that they should already have in their files, and yet they're just absolutely hysterical about it. And so in the face of all that backlash, the regulators have just really been dragging their feet on it. And I'm a little bit hopeful about the Securities and Exchange Commission has a new head there, Mary Jo White, who seems to really be trying to get things moving. But it's been quite a shock to see that, you know, so long after Congress has actually voted on the thing and the president signed it, that they can still bog it down like this.
Sarah, you know, one of the things that I think angers myself, I'm sure you are, and many of our listeners are, is the fact that despite all the malfeasance, unethical or at least unethical, if not illegal, behavior on the part of many of these financial institutions and their heads that led to the global financial crisis and so much loss of wealth by people who couldn't afford it, that to date, none of these folks who were key players in this mess have been held accountable and have gone to jail. Not one.
Isn't it just incredible? I mean, I think all the time about Angelo Mozzillo, who was the CEO of Countrywide Financial, and they were at the forefront of the subprime mortgage lending. They were, you know, the biggest subprime mortgage lender, and that guy made out, you know, over the years leading up to the crisis, hundreds of millions of dollars in compensation. I remember being on one of these cable business shows once and being critical of that because it was kind of in the early days of the bubble, and it just having my head bitten off. Oh, how could you dare criticize this man? You know, he's built this company up so much and all. And the whole thing fell apart. Countrywide Financial doesn't even exist anymore, and he's gotten a slap on the wrist. He paid a fine that was, you know, just a drop in the bucket for somebody like him. And to think that today he, you know, so many people lost their homes because of that guy's greed, and nothing has been done. And it's so discouraging. And I do feel like kind of the momentum that we had a bit after the crisis seems to be waning, as people thought, well, we passed financial reform, let's move on, and things haven't changed that much.
And I think they call that moral hazard, right, where people get away with, horrible activity that hurts so many, and that's a lesson to many other people in the same line of work and inclined to be dishonest or deceptive in what they do. It basically, beyond the bonuses, the fact that no one in this industry has been held accountable is a real incentive to again, high-risk behavior.
Exactly. And we just heard about a few weeks ago that Jamie Dimon, the CEO of J.P. Morgan, which, has had one scandal after another lately with their big $20 billion loss because of reckless trading and various criminal penalties and all. He just got a 75% raise. And so, it was a situation, again, where there was a board that approved his pay package that's made up of CEOs from other boards, and they made a decision that, to, every ordinary American would think is just completely insane, but in their world, it makes sense.
Sarah Anderson is our guest, and she's from the Institute for Policy Studies. We're talking about her report, Wall Street Bonuses and the Minimum Wage. And Sarah, before we forget to mention it, what's the website people can go to get a copy of the summary and the report itself?
Yeah, well, it's the Institute for Policy Studies, and our web address is ips-dc.org.
Okay. Well, we'll mention that in a moment or two when we close out, but... in terms of the Occupy Wall Street movement, back in 2011, the fall of 2011, it sprouted up all over the country and around the world, and they were focused on a lot of the same issues in terms of accountability of our broken financial system and our broken political system, which seemed, to be linked inextricably. And one of the interesting things that I've heard of that took place in Switzerland, and you might want to comment on this, is that they had a referendum in the country to cap executive salaries. And it's been a complaint, in terms of inequality in this country that, the top executives at various large corporations in the country make, hundreds times more than the lowest paid worker. Well, that was something that was addressed in Switzerland. And I'm not sure of the results, although I know that some parts of a cap were implemented, but not completely what was on the ballot. Maybe you can speak to that briefly, Sarah, to see if there's any lessons we can learn from Switzerland on that.
Yeah, that was really exciting. It was a lot of young people who did a heck of a job of organizing this citizens' referendum there, and it was to really have a firm ceiling on how much you could make in that country, but using the ratio of 12 to 1. You couldn't make more than 12 times your lowest paid worker, and the reasoning behind it, the reason they settled on 12 to 1 was they didn't think that people should make more in a month than somebody else makes in a year. And this really took off among the Swiss public, and the polling was showing that it actually had a chance of winning. In the end, there was just, a huge hysteria campaign by all these corporations threatening to leave the country, and, the economy would just shrivel up and die kind of rhetoric. And so it did not pass. It got a, pretty good showing. I think it was maybe 30% or something like that. They did, like you said, they got something else through, and I can't recall the specifics. I think it might have had to do with golden parachutes or something like that. They did win. But I think that what they did show was, this was a really pretty radical proposal, even by my standards, and they showed that even with something that bold, you could really get a significant share of the public behind it, and it invigorated such an interesting debate, because a lot of big, very competitive companies came out and said, hey, we're already at 8 to 1, or we're at 10 to 1, so this doesn't bother us, and it put a big spotlight on the other companies there. There's pharmaceutical companies in Switzerland that had ratios of like 1,000 to 1, and really off the charts. And so I think that this whole idea of the ratio has just, it's become much more of a legitimate benchmark for looking at companies and raising questions about, you know, is there something wrong with the governance, you know, here if the board is approving pay packages that are that out of line with the rest of the workers?
Sarah, you know, I'd like to get your response to some of the justifications used by these big financial institutions to hand out these very large bonuses. They say they have to reward their brokers or high-performing brokers, or else they're going to lose them to competitive companies. Do you have any sympathy with that line?
Well, it's the same line that they used, you know, right after the crash, that the people who had actually caused the crash also needed these retention bonuses because they couldn't possibly lose this top talent. So I guess I don't pay a lot of credence to that argument anymore, especially after the CEO of AIG, which was a major player, people recall, in the crash. He recently said that he thought all of the outcry about the bonuses, even after companies got the taxpayer bailouts, they were still giving out these massive bonuses. He compared it to lynchings, like in the you know, American South, and really, you know, raised a lot of people's blood pressure there. So, you know, I think these people are really living on another planet and thinking that they're really above others. And if you look at financial sector workers in other countries, they're not making anywhere near the amount of money that they are here, and yet there are very vibrant financial markets in other parts of the world. So I think we need to, you know, get away from this idea that these are just these irreplaceable geniuses and remind ourselves that many of these same people got us into the crash in 08.
Sarah, just a final question here, and that is, as you mentioned earlier, there are many states that have passed minimum wage laws that are moving the stagnant minimum wage ahead. At the federal level, it seems that the minimum wage legislation isn't going to go very far, mostly because the House of Representatives, controlled by the Republicans, basically don't want any part of it. And with public opinion, from what I've read, very much on the side of increasing the minimum wage to make up for the loss of value of the minimum wage due to inflation over the years where it's not been raised, What, in your opinion, is the most effective thing that people can do to increase the visibility of this issue going into the November midterm elections?
Well, I think the local and state campaigns are really exciting. I think one of the best things that happened in our area here in 2013 was that the D.C. City Council got together with the neighboring jurisdictions in Maryland and paid and passed a very high minimum wage. I think it's $11.50 an hour. And that just, it really energized a lot of groups that are now going on to work on, you know, additional kinds of economic justice issues. And so, you know, when we're blocked at the federal level, I'm a huge fan of really building things from the bottom up. And, yeah, we'll see what happens in the House. My understanding is that the Senate is planning to vote probably the end of April or early May. I think it's likely that it could pass in the Senate, and then the pressure will really be on. As you said, the public opinion polls show this is so broadly supported, and facing an election in the fall, will Republicans really be willing to just hand this issue to the Democrats? I don't know. Hopefully that can help motivate them to do the right thing. But in the meantime, I think these local level living wage campaigns are just terrific.
Well, we're out of time, Sarah. Thanks so much for joining us this evening. And leave our listeners one more time the web address where they can get a copy of the report you wrote, Wall Street Bonuses and the Minimum Wage.
Great. Yep. So I work at the Institute for Policy Studies, and our web address is ips-dc.org.
All right. Well, thanks so much again for spending time with us, Sarah. Appreciate the report, all the hard work put into that, and exposing a real calamity in terms of inequality in this sphere that you researched. So thanks again, and we'll look forward to talking with you again.
Thanks to you.
Bye-bye. Take care. Bye-bye. That's Sarah Anderson, Global Economy Project Director with the Institute for Policy Studies in Washington. And the name of the report, again, is Wall Street Bonuses and the Minimum Wage. That does it for us tonight on Counterpoint. We hope you'll tune in again next Monday evening between 8 and 10. We're going to be featuring a lot of commentary on many of the issues you might care about. But we always like to hear from you, so you can write to us at betweenthelines@snet.net, betweenthelines@snet.net. And please do support this community radio station with a contribution or volunteer help. Go to our website, wpkn.org, and you can find out about upcoming events, our program guide if you're new to the station, as well as where you can make a secure online contribution to help keep this listener-supported station afloat. Thanks for being here, and the writer's voice is coming up after this announcement, so we hope you'll stay tuned here on WPKN in Bridgeport.
Support for WPKN comes from Tanarawin, bringing their Desert Blues to the Ridgefield Playhouse on March 26th. Blues from the Sahara, African percussion, and poetry. For information, ridgefieldplayhouse.org or 203-438-5795.
Pro-feminist men.
We're really at the beginning of this new era, and I think that whether or not one uses the word pro-feminist or anti-sexist or just, I just want to do the right thing, I'm not as interested in the terminology as I am in advancing this transformation of men and masculinity.
That's Rob Okun. He's edited a collection of articles from the pro-feminist men's journal, Voicemail. That's M-A-L-E. It's called Voicemail, the Untold Story of the Pro-Feminist Men's Movement. Then we re-air our 2009 interview with feminist poet Robin Moore about the anthology she edited, Poems from the Women's Movement. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. We celebrated International Women's Day on March 8th. First celebrated in 1910, it became generally adopted as a holiday in the U.S. in the 1980s. Improvements in opportunities for women have been great since the modern feminist movement began in 1970. Yet women still earn about 77% of the pay men do in similar jobs. They're still 85% of the victims of domestic violence, with about a quarter of all U.S. women assaulted at some point in their lives. My guest, Rob Okun, says that men need to step up to the plate to fight for women's equal rights and an end to domestic violence. What's at stake is not only ending injustice against women, but also promoting the freedom for men to become more fully themselves as human beings. Society's notions of masculinity rob men of connection to their inner selves and to others, Okun says. Men can only be free if women are. That's the premise of the pro-feminist men's movement. Rob Okun has been dedicating himself to that cause since the early 1980s. He was a founder of the Men's Resource Center for Change in Amherst, Massachusetts, and started that organization's magazine, Voicemail.